You're listening to Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium, and I'm Catherine Davis. On today's program, we're going to have a very interesting conversation, and we're going to be looking at whistleblower protection and whether or not there really is a need for additional whistleblower protection. Because as we look at our media and we look at the state of our world, it's a very confusing message that we receive. And sometimes the truth is not the most obvious. We're joined today by author Michael McCray. And he's going to be looking at this situation about whistleblowers. And he has a lot of information to share. He is a respected attorney and leading public advocate. He is a sought-after corporate speaker whose message of integrity, business ethics, and empowerment is changing the way America does business. Michael's information is very inspirational, motivational, and encourages us to take action fearlessly and make a stand for integrity, both socially and civilly. Michael McCray's best-selling book, Race, Power, and Politics, The Inside Story of ACORN, is available nationwide. Hello and welcome, Michael.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you for having me on.
I'm very happy to have you on because this is a very interesting topic, and it's important because people may not realize that they have an opportunity to make a difference by sharing correct information. But before getting to some of these questions in terms of whistleblower protection and the deep state and all the different things that might be part of this conversation, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? And as well, remind people about ACORN, because some of us may have forgotten the details of that story.
Sure. Again, thank you for having me on. My name is Michael McCray, and I grew up in the Arkansas River Delta, area where the soil was rich but the people were poor. My hometown, Pine Bluff, Arkansas, was once named the worst place to live in America 2 years in a row. But despite this background, this humble beginnings, I was able to go away and go to school and get a good education. I attended Georgetown Law School and got a MBA in finance from Howard University. And I tell people a funny thing happened on my way to Wall Street. My governor ran for president, and I got to work for the White House. So I was able to use my background in finance and economics to work for the Clinton administration, the Clinton White House's Federal Empowerment Zones program. You may remember that, but actually New York received a lot of money for a urban empowerment zone. But this was the community development package for the Clinton administration, and it was the largest social welfare program since Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society programs. So I got to work in economic development, and it really was my dream job because I was able to use my skills and my background to help build communities just like my hometown. And so I really was very, very pleased, empowered. I was very eager. I was, at that point in time, I was the young kid that was going around the country. The internet wasn't new, but the World Wide Web was. So we were teaching nonprofit organizations and development entities how to use technology for community development. To make a long story short, in that capacity, I discovered that $40 million was being funneled to a nonprofit organization that I knew didn't have the capacity to operate the funding. And so I wound up asking a question in staff meeting, and it was really that simple, was, you know, does this seem like a good idea to give $40 million to an organization that can't handle the money? And that's all it really takes to become a whistleblower. I tell people, you can blow the whistle by accident. All you have to do is ask the wrong question at the wrong time, and what happens is you become a threat to the system, whether it's a corporation or a government agency. And what happens then is that you'll slowly start to see your duties change. You'll start to see different forms of management retaliation. And that's the other thing that I talk about in my corporate speaking, is that bad managers make good employees blow the whistle because they do so in self-defense. So I became a federal whistleblower. I blew the whistle on $40 million that was being funneled to a congressional district in Mississippi that was the former congressional district that then Secretary Mike Espy had vacated, but his brother Henry Espy was running for. So it was kind of there was undue political influence on a program that should have been strictly merit based. It changed my life forever. I went from being the golden child to basically a pariah in the office. I had the full journey. I lost my job. I lost business interests. I lost my fiance. And so there's another thing that people don't realize is that you never blow the whistle alone. You never blow the whistle by yourself. When you blow the whistle, your whole family blows the whistle. And so it affects your professional life and also your personal lives. This often leads to bouts with depression, alcoholism, drug addiction, even death. 10% of whistleblowers actually commit suicide. So I came to the point where, I like to say that rock bottom was the firm foundation on which I rebuilt my life, and I did it through two ways. First, my father gave me a copy of Rick Warren's book, A Purpose-Driven Life, and that kind of helped change my perspective on how to view the problem. And two, I attended a conference of whistleblowers in Washington, D.C. about 10 years ago. And that conference then was called Washington Whistleblowers Week. And there I was able to combat the isolation that I was experiencing because I found like-minded people. I found my tribe. And it was really the mutual support, the camaraderie it really saved my life. I tell people, coming to the Whistleblower Conference saved my life and it saved my sanity. So one of the ways that I give back is now I host the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights, which is the largest and most prestigious whistleblower conference on Capitol Hill every year. So it's a way for me to give back to the community. And we've been having these summits, for the past 6 or 7 years now. And we do it we always have the summit is anchored on July 30th because that's National Whistleblower Appreciation Day. So just a little background, the term whistleblower was used widely during the 70s, essentially following the anti-war protests, you know, the Pentagon Papers, and then also there was some consumer protection advocacy going on in the 70s, too. I think that was led by Ralph Nader. So while the term whistleblower came out of the 70s, the actual first whistleblower law was enacted by the Continental Congress in 1778. So whistleblowing is really tied to the First Amendment. Back then, the founders decided that, well, they decreed that it was the duty of every American citizen to report to Congress at first time available any governmental wrongdoing. So this is a part of free speech. It's a part of the First Amendment. It is really part of what allows us to allows our democracy to be free. So I've become, that was kind of my journey, how I got involved in whistleblowing and the my current advocacy. As a result, I know a lot of whistleblowers, and these people have beautiful souls. They may live tortured lives, but they have beautiful souls. And one of the groups that I wound up working with is a group of ACORN whistleblowers. And you all may remember that ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, was the community action group that former President Barack Obama worked with in Chicago. He was an organizer for ACORN, and he was also a trainer for ACORN. So this is a very powerful organization. There's a very strong chapter of ACORN in New York. And around 2008, there was an embezzlement. It turned out to be a multi-million dollar embezzlement. And there were a group of board members, eight board members, that demanded to have a forensic examination and a comprehensive audit. They were seeking truth, transparency, and accountability in an effort to save ACORN from the malfeasance. Ultimately, this wound up playing in the national news. It was on CNN. It was breaking news on CNN. They were on the nightly news with Brian Williams. It was also the story that really launched Glenn Beck's show on Fox News. So this whole story went wild. And they came to me for assistance, and I wound up being the national spokesperson for the ACORN 8. That's what the whistleblowers were known as. And I actually wound up writing two books about it. My first book was Race, Power, and Politics, Memoirs of an ACORN Whistleblower, which really explains the backstory of why people get involved in direct action organizations, why they're important, and why people join ACORN. And actually, my new book that'll be out this fall is Truth, Transparency, and Accountability. And again, that was the rallying call for the ACORN 8, which was the justice that they sought. So I've kind of come full circle with my whistleblowing, first being a whistleblower, but then being able to turn that experience into activism and to help other whistleblowers and really to help society. You know, I say that whistleblowers protect society, but who protects whistleblowers? And so that's why we formed the Whistleblower Summit. And we write books. We bring together whistleblowers and advocates. We have policy prescriptions. We bring in media. So it's a very comprehensive program that seeks to put whistleblowing back into its proper historical perspective and let people know that despite all the pejoratives, because if you look at whistleblower, you know, you'll get words like rat, fink, snitch. You know, there are 20 pejoratives that people use for whistleblowers, but really whistleblowers are heroes. And that's kind of what we promote at the summit.
That sounds so fascinating. And I do see that in our discourse in terms of government regulations that whistleblowers have been protected less and less and less. So I'm wondering if you could distinguish for me, just to start out, the difference between whom you consider to be a real whistleblower and something like WikiLeaks. You don't really consider that to be a whistleblower.
That's one of the popular topics at the summit is who are whistleblowers. Because sometimes we laugh when we see some people that they're interested in whistleblowing, and they come to the summit, but they, of course, a lot of people reject the term. They don't want to be associated with the book. Again, because a lot of times the term is considered a pejorative. But, you know, and they may or may not have filed a formal complaint, but they have done something that has identified themselves with the system. And a lot of the conference attendees, we kind of sit back like, you know, look, we understand what you're going through and what you're about to go through, and while you may not consider yourself a whistleblower now, we'll leave the light on for you. So we'll see you back here next year. But who we consider whistleblowers are people that have access to legitimate information and discover wrongdoing at their work or their place of employment, and they report it to the authorities or to the public or to, you know, to the press. And so there are people who are, and they do it proactively. So there are people who have stand something to lose. They have skin in the game. And they're really just someone who sees something wrong and tries to fix it. Kind of distinguish that between, you know, for instance, let's talk about the mob. Say, we don't consider Sammy the Bull Gravone a whistleblower. You know, he was an indicted co-conspirator. He was somebody who participated in the wrongdoing and then told in order to help himself. That's really not what a whistleblower, that's not who we identify as whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are proactive. And so a lot of times people kind of talk about what's going on. The example, you raised another great example, WikiLeaks. So the person is Julian Assange. And so as a matter of fact, there was a movie about Julian Assange that came out a few years ago, and participant media actually came to the Whistleblower Summit, and we had a press conference at the National Press Club. And one of the things the whistleblowers identified for the studio was that Julian Assange is not a whistleblower. Chelsea Manning was the whistleblower, the person who turned over the information, the person who had legitimate access to the information and thought it was wrong, turned it over to an outlet. Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, is actually a publisher. Probably a better term for them would be Julian Assange is a hacktivist. You know, someone who breaks into a computer or a network or an organization and steals information illegally and then republishes it, that's not whistleblowing. Or if our community does not consider that whistleblowing, that's actually theft. And WikiLeaks takes the position that they don't believe in any secrets. They believe in total truth. And so while we can argue about classification and overclassification of government documents, and because sometimes, you know, the classification are more political than on an actual need for national security. But there are legitimate state secrets. There are legitimate government interests that need to be protected. So that's one of the things where, you know, a lot of people lump Julian Assange or WikiLeaks in with whistleblowers, but really they're not. They're a publishing platform.
They are sort of a source point. If somebody wants to leak some information, they might feel safer perhaps giving it to an organization like WikiLeaks rather than suffering.
They are. But again, now that with what's going on with, I guess, the free press and the internet and telephony, I mean, you have a lot of organizations that will actually publish information. So there's some of the NGOs, some of the non-governmental organizations. I mean, WikiLeaks is one. You've got The Guardian, Project on Government Oversight. There are actually a number of different places that say that they perform that type of function. WikiLeaks probably has the broadest platform or is most well known for that, essentially due to the information that Chelsea Manning exposed related to the war.
So what would you say to people who do have this information and they want to do the right thing, but they're afraid to do the right thing?
Right. Well, first thing I would say is be very careful and understand that there are different, I kind of call them neighborhoods of whistleblowers, different avenues. So the whistleblowing one is really the statutory framework is very complex. And so there are a number of different agencies that you may go to. There's some stuff that may be OSHA violations. Some stuff falls under Sarbanes-Oxley. So it's actually a complicated quilt of protections and laws and regulations that you have to comply with. So one thing I'd say is don't do anything rash and get as much information you can as possible. I, of course, would encourage people to perhaps attend a conference like mine, the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights. There are other books that you can read. Two very good ones are The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide, but it's really good for any form of whistleblower. It's written by Tom Devine. And then there's also the Whistleblower's Handbooks. that are written by Stephen Cohen of the National Whistleblower Center. So first thing you want to do is arm yourself with information. Second thing you want to do is talk to advocates, talk to other whistleblowers or people that have taken the journey that you may be undertaking. And also you need to understand that there's a difference between, in one sense, doing what I did, blowing the whistle on USDA versus blowing the whistle on the FBI or the CIA. So when you get into areas of national security, you know, a lot of the protections change and there's a lot less protection. When you're a law enforcement whistleblower or even in the military, understand that every day your life is placed in danger. So, you know, it's while I did feel that my life was threatened when I blew the whistle at USDA, you're really putting your life on the line every day in these command and control environments. And so when you blow the whistle there, you know, all it takes is for somebody not to answer your call for backup, and your life is on the line. So it really is life or death. So, and then judicial whistleblowers, judicial reform advocates, there's different rules of, how do you go about reporting malfeasance on the courts. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Again, forewarned is forearmed. And I would suggest that you make more connections and really kind of research. Really, you really need to look before you leap.
And do you, in addition to having these conferences, provide counsel to people who want to take that path?
We formed, again, one of the main reasons that we have the conference is to create a sense of community. So the Whistleblower Summit, it operates within a network of whistleblowers, public interest advocates, NGOs, nonprofit organizations. So there are different, I guess I should, but I don't. I tend to help whistleblowers if I can or to refer them. But there are different levels, from small ad hoc groups to labor unions that participate in the summits and are active in the whistleblower community. It's actually an umbrella group called MISC, the Make It Safe Coalition, which represents a few hundred different whistleblower advocates and NGOs.
So the help is out there for people who want to do it. I want to go a little bit deeper into this, but if people wanted to find out more about your summit, how would they connect with you to do that?
The easiest way to find out about the summit is to go to www.whistleblowersummit.com, whistleblowersummit.com. That'll take you straight to the website. If you want to reach me, you can go to michaelmccray.net. And even if you want to find more information about what really happened with ACORN, you can go to www.acorn8.com. Again, www.acorn8.com.
Excellent, excellent. So we'll give people contact information again as we go forward, because people may actually want to get a copy of your book, Race, Power, and Politics, The Inside Story of ACORN, or may want to find out more about your upcoming book when it's ready to be published. So we want to make sure people can maintain those connections. I would like to go into some of this history of whistleblowing. You mentioned something about the Panama Papers, and also in looking at what WikiLeaks has done, there's a real interaction with government. And maybe you can give us some context on what has to happen to ensure that our government and our corporations remain ethical and are not allowed to engage in corrupt behavior.
Right. Well, let me give you a few more stats. One of the things that sometimes when people ask, what makes people blow the whistle, where do whistleblowers come from? The largest number of whistleblowers come from the government sector. They're federal employees. And part of the reason for that is that me being a former federal employee, I can explain why. What happens is you feel that federal employees feel like they have your public trust. That I feel like in addition to my job and working for my organization, I work for the American people. So when federal employees see things that are wrong, they feel a responsibility to the public. So, for instance, someone who works in USDA recognizes that if I don't report the pink slime coming out of the cows, that people will get poisoned. And so, therefore, just an example. So, therefore, you'll find the largest number of whistleblowers come from the federal sector because the employees feel like they have a dual obligation to their job but to the public at large. Second largest number of whistleblowers come out of the nonprofit sector. So while they may not work for the federal government directly, they believe that they work for a charitable organization that has some commitment to the public and also for the taxpayer funding or taxpayer dollars that flow through their organization. So they also feel a dual conflict or a dual responsibility that they serve their organization, but they do also serve society. And the least number of whistleblowers come out of the private sector, and it's kind of, you know, that's their business model and their business, and that's more, you definitely have more of the go-along, the get-along. But then there's still laws that protect the public from bad actors and evil corporations. So that's kind of a psychological framework of where whistleblowers come from. And that also gets to the issue that you're talking about, the importance of whistleblowing to the government. The reason that I talk about the Panama Papers is there was a consortium of investigative journalists that did this research project that really traced corruption globally. They got access to bank records of many different nations, of the rich and powerful politicians, the oligarchs, and they did this comprehensive paper called the Panama Papers, which is probably one of the most important documents in terms of identifying global corruption. And so that's another thing, that whistleblowing is not, while it's tied to the First Amendment here in America, it's really a global phenomenon as you start to look for transparency and good government all across the globe. And it becomes much more challenging to deal with these type of First Amendment issues in a country that has a totalitarian government. So, you know, it's one thing to blow the whistle. It's one thing to blow the whistle in America when you have free speech, but apparently now we may not. And versus blowing the whistle in places like Russia, where the government can really sanction your assassination. So that's kind of what the Panama Papers gets to. I think, were you also asking me about the deep state, Catherine, or was there another part to your question?
Yeah. You answered most of the question, because I was looking at, when you broke down the different kinds of whistleblowers. But, yeah, the deep state is also something that I'm very much interested in, because that seems to be, that's according to my perception, our own United States government is being run by a deep state or somebody other than the people, certainly. And even Congress seems to be very much compromised by special interests, corporate interests. So it's hard for me to really figure out what's going on there.
Right. Well, I think right now the use of the term deep state is kind of fake news. But then again, also with, I watch Scandal. And so I guess B16 would be considered a deep, in command would be considered a deep state. But I think a more accurate diagnosis of what happens is that in the federal government, you have career civil servants and political appointees. And in the past, what has happened is when the administration changes, the political appointees go, but the people that actually run the government, the bureaucrats, they stay as a part of their civil service. From time to time, you'll have political appointees that burrow into the civil service. So they may have started with a political appointment, but sometimes they're able to get hired into the federal bureaucracy itself. And a lot of times, you may have Ronald Reagan comes into office, you have Republicans that are political appointees, but these people become a part of the bureaucratic state. And when, the Clintons come in or the Democrats come in, you know, sometimes people believe that they may still be acting with a more political motivation than necessarily the public good. So that happens from time to time. I think the use of the term deep state it sensationalizes it, but I don't think there's nothing more going on. I don't see that there's anything going on more today than has happened in the past 10 or 20 years. I think we just have I guess because we have a brander in chief now, he's able to brand this deep state as a problem. And to me, it's more of a red herring used to distract the people away from a very interesting investigation going on by the Mueller team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't really see this concept of the deep state as being unique to this particular administration. And one of the things, I guess when I look at think tanks, like right-wing think tanks or left-wing think tanks, who come up with ideology and write papers about where they want to see the world going, the direction in the next 100 years or 20 years, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And then they begin to endeavor to put that ideology, move that through the government structure. And they do that, from my perspective, through funding. Through funding candidates that are going to represent their ideology, and perhaps working against candidates who are against their ideology. And it may be that this whole phenomena has to do with money in politics, but to me there seems to be a controlling factor behind the politicians that are actually designing the movement of regulations, laws, and votes in Congress.
Catherine, I think that a deep state probably is more applicable to what you just described. Have you read Dark Money? I forget who wrote the book. But if you haven't, you should read Dark Money, and it really explains essentially the oligarchs that are running the country. And it kind of talks about what happened after the 60s and maybe some of the 70s with some of the environmental protections, that corporate America decided that they wanted to retake control of the government because turn it away from a lot of the progressiveness that came out of the civil rights movements and its aftermath. And basically it's been, a 40-year battle where they've built institutions and impact academia and with these think tanks and other things, and they'll fund writers that have a certain that adhere to their ideological slant. And so it's really fascinating, but it really starts to talk about where these major corporations essentially decided to take back control of the company by controlling both political parties and influencing higher education.
Yeah, I see that as well. I guess that's kind of my concept of what the deep state is.
Right.
But it strikes me that this is really the force that whistleblowers are encountering when they bring up a wrong or something that's immoral or corrupt that's happening in the government, that they are facing, you know, this huge force of, I don't know what to call it, but this movement that continues to protect this control factor that's being instituted in our government.
Right.
And it's why they're in such danger, because all of this money is behind it.
Right. Well, money and power.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, the money and power also impacts the courts. And so that's one of the biggest life lessons that all whistleblowers are going to encounter. Because again, the reason that people aren't really crazy when they blow the whistle. It seems like a rational thing to do. But once you get inside and you start to take your whistleblower journey, you know, it's kind of like whistleblowers understand that the deck may be stacked against them, but they didn't expect that, but they never knew that the game was rigged. And so that's a large part of the coping and coming back and building and rebuilding yourself that you'll go through on your whistleblower journey.
Mm-hmm. And do whistleblowers ever win?
Wow, great question. It kind of depends on how do you define a win? I tend to speak in terms of survival, of whistleblowers surviving their journey. There are cases, let me do it this way. While the first whistleblower protection law was written in 1778, the most effective whistleblower law was signed into law in 1862 by Abraham Lincoln. And this was the False Claims Act. So what was going on was during the Civil War, there were a lot of defense contractors that were basically selling the federal government defective goods. And so Abraham Lincoln signed a law that essentially provides a reward for. So if you report somebody who's defrauding the government, a whistleblower can get from 10 to 30% of what the government is able to recover. So if you save the government, you know, in my case, it would have been $40 million. I would have been able to get something like $10 million. So that, in that sense, occasionally, I mean, there are some whistleblowers who've won large recoveries like that. But in the aggregate, the overall chance of winning a whistleblower winning their case is something like 2%. But again, it depends on how you frame the win. So what I've done is I rebuilt the career that I thought I had that I wanted. But I've rebuilt my career. I've rebuilt my life. I've become an author. And one of the things that I tell whistleblowers this is that while you may lose your case, every whistleblower I know has an incredible story. And one of the things that we're going to be advocating at the Whistleblower Summit this year is to use the power of story. So you may no longer be a doctor or a lawyer, but now you're an author, now you're a speaker, now you're a radio host, now you're a filmmaker. You know, that there are other things that you can take your journey and reconceptualize yourself and start a new career. So, again, you kind of get to the point of exactly what is a win.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any sense of the aggregate sort of positive impact on the overall society or what's happening in the world, that even if your personal life might be crushed, you might have made a difference?
Absolutely. I think in the past dozen years, the community of whistleblowers, I think, have passed something like 13 laws. Whistleblowers have an impact on society, and that's the thing. You don't really want to look at the whistleblower's value in terms of necessarily their balance sheet, you know, how large is their home, but you got to think of whistleblowers more like, think of them like activists, like Martin Luther King or Mother Teresa. I mean, there are people with conscience, people with integrity make contributions to society that are worth so much more than money. But if you kind of look in this crass materialism of today's society, while you think these people have lost, but they contribute so much to society, and I think that's the point of view, that's the perspective that I like all whistleblowers to be viewed through.
Yes, I agree. I think that's where it really does make a difference, and that it's the only way that positive change is going to happen when you think about the, like you said, the finances and power behind the manipulation and control on a governmental level or corporate level, or the intermingling of the corporate structure and those representatives in the government that are actually supposed to be representing the people's interests,
Right. But
when you look at it, you realize that they're truly not representing the greater proportion of people.
The whole concept of regulatory capture, I think that's such an interesting word. But regulatory capture refers to the fact that many of the employees who worked with the agencies that may have oversight over a certain industry oftentimes get hired by the industry subsequent to their work. So if you're someone, if let's say your job, you work for the SEC and you're supposed to regulate the investment banks, well, 2 years from now, you know, 4 years from now, you're going to be working for one of the larger investment banks. And so essentially what has happened is by the carrot of future job prospects and having good relations has essentially allowed corporations, the industry themselves, to capture the regulators. And that is exactly what you just described.
Yeah, I've seen that happen in a lot of industries. And it's sort of the anti-whistleblower effect. People who are willing to sell out, if you will, use their skills to benefit the corporate powers and finances instead of continuing to work on behalf of the people, the planet. So what's really interesting to me about this is that we never know in our lives when we're going to be in a position to be a whistleblower. So I think you covered this in terms of first steps. It's really to be to educate yourself. You don't want to blunder into being a whistleblower. Is that correct?
Yeah, you don't want to, but it happens all the time. I mean, that's yeah. One of the things, because even the question about how do you become prepared for it, it assumes that you're proactively thinking about it. In most situations, it's a person, and it may be, and this is an interesting question. You know, was it how you were born? What value system? Did you go to church? Did you have strict parents? Whatever it is, but sometimes there'll be people that will be faced in an instant with seeing something wrong or clearly wrong. And some people's reaction is to, you know, is to stop the child from being molested. Some people's reaction is to look the other way. You know, and it's the people whose reflex that is to fix a problem or avert a problem who are most likely going to wind up going down the slippery slope. But it's not like they planned. I didn't, like for the Penn State example. When I went to the athletic dorm, I didn't plan on seeing a child being molested. Either I saw it and either I did something or I didn't. And so wherever that comes from, whether that's your faith in God, faith in the ancestors, your spirituality, I'm not exactly sure where it comes from, but the very first test of being a whistleblower is going to come from your basic morals and values. Are you the type of person who stands by, or are you the person who does something, who takes a stand?
Yeah, and another interesting thing, if you can stay on for a few more minutes, I really am interested in what we can do as a society to protect whistleblowers, as you say, because there are a lot of, well, actually since the whole last election with Bernie Sanders, people feel him not getting the deal, a fair passage into the forum, the political forum, I've noticed that there are a lot more people who are running for office locally, local offices, local governments, as a way of addressing some of these problems. How would you merge these two together for someone who's actively going into politics for ethical reasons, how they might put forth some protections for whistleblowers and right. How they might interact with what they might see when they get there? Because I'm under the assumption that many politicians at the start of their career have the best of intentions and want to do good, but all along the way they get corrupted.
I think it's a system. You kind of say one bad arrow. You know, people tend to think that one bad apple spoils the bunch, but in politics and in court and the courts, the barrel is rotten, and so it's kind of it can be a very corrupting game once you get involved. I'm one of the people that when we kind of talk about whistleblower protections, to me it's kind of an oxymoron. I speak more in terms of whistleblower redress. So it's things that you may or may not be able to do after you face the retaliation. I know there are a number of whistleblower protection laws that are on the books, but to me, in practical terms, the protection is very little to nothing. But again, part of the problem is that you wind up in an experience that you now have to respond to. It may or may not have been as planned as many people think blowing the whistle is.
Yeah, I think as often as not, it isn't planned. It's, you're confronted right. with something and can't live with it and have to take an action. And I think probably people even realize in some cases when they're blowing the whistle that they're going to suffer for it and are making that choice, which to me is all the more reason to consider many of these people as just heroes that are willing to take that journey.
Right, they are. They absolutely are. Well, and the other thing now is that, once upon a time, the retaliation was you lose your job. But I hate to say this, but, we started to see more actual prosecution of whistleblowers during the Obama administration, and I don't think it's tapered off now under President Trump. So I tell people that now it's not, it's not just you lose your job, but, now they're trying to send people to jail. So to me, whistleblowers and journalists are becoming Americans' prisoners of war or political prisoners.
Yeah, I see that as well. It's once the government is under control, then absolute control of the information is this next step that we're living in right now, which is really can be seen, this whole controversy of news, fake news, to the point that it's impossible really to tell the difference between news and fake news any longer. I would also, if you would, how does this work in terms of organizations, corporations, nonprofits who want to remain ethical? Because I know that you do some counseling on that point, I understand that you talk about what does a corporation or an organization need to look at, not just to prevent whistleblowing, but to begin to address these issues that are being brought to the table rather than making it escalate out of control.
Right, right. Well, essentially what you're doing is you're changing corporate culture. And, I mean, that's the fundamental shift that all these organizations have to have. And there's a lot of myths and misconceptions about whistleblowers. Like, for one, that the poor employee is the whistleblower. And that's almost never the case. It's kind of like when I was in school, the person that was cheating on the test wasn't the A student. It was the D student that was cheating, trying to get by. So the people that are more apt to blow the whistle are actually your good employees, people that feel comfortable and assertive enough in their position that they think that if they see a problem that they can actually take it to management and have it addressed. So the person that's on the edge, they're not lifting their head up. They're not trying to make any waves. They're not trying to rock the boat. But it's actually your better employees are going to be the ones that are more likely going to wind up in a situation where they can become whistleblowers. And then, as I said before, how the organization responds to the information that the employee brings, that they're not a whistleblower yet, but the whistleblower brings to them. So if the culture of the organization is to smack them down and to punish them, then that's a bad management style. And again, as I said, it's the bad managers that are actually forcing the good employee to blow the whistle. And so the other concepts that you have to deal with is that whistleblowers are really the conscience of your company, and they're like the canaries in the coal mine. So if you don't listen to, there's a high cost for not listening to the people that are bringing you information that you may not like to hear. I think a great example internationally now was when Volkswagen had changing the programs or I guess cooking the books on the emission standards. So they saved a few pennies by trying to get around government regulators, but ultimately you know, the ultimate fines, when everything came out, the cost was so much more to the organization that had they listened to the voice of dissent, the company could have saved all this money and their reputation. So those are the things that I like to talk to. Corporations and companies about, and how you again. I can't, when I go to companies, I can't really talk about whistleblowers per se, but the conversation becomes business ethics and corporate integrity.
Very, very good. Just to remind our listeners, we are listening to Michael McCray, Esquire, a respected attorney and leading public advocate. Michael McCray is a sought-after corporate speaker whose message of integrity, business ethics, and empowerment is changing the way America does business. Michael's information motivates and inspires, and hopefully people will be more willing to take action and stand up for integrity, both socially and civilly. His first book, Race, Power, and Politics, The Inside Story of Acorn, is currently available nationwide. And Michael, what is the name of your upcoming book again?
Truth, Transparency, and Accountability.
Excellent, excellent. And could you give the contact information and websites out again for people who might not have got it the first time?
Sure. People that are interested in the Whistleblower Summit can go to www.whistleblowersummit.com, whistleblowersummit.com. If people want information about Acorn and what really happened inside the fall of Acorn, you can go to www.acorn8.com. That's, once again, that's acorn8.com. Or if you want to contact me directly, you can go to www.michaelmccray.net. Again, michaelmccray.net.
Excellent, excellent. And do you have any thoughts that we might not have covered so far, or a closing comment you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, Catherine, you're a great interview, and I think we've kind of touched on the whole gamut. I just want to reiterate this about the importance of whistleblowers to our democracy, because you have to understand that there is no free press without news sources. There is no congressional oversight without government informants. Whistleblowers are the fifth estate that protect our freedom and liberty. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much for joining me today on Heart of Mind, Radio for the New Millennium. And, well, I certainly know who to call when I need more information on whistleblowing protection and what's going on. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Thank you, Catherine.
Okay. Bye-bye for now. And you're listening to Heart of Mind, Radio for the New Millennium. I'm Catherine Davis, and this is the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. For those of you who listen to this show, you realize that this is primarily a show about spirituality, consciousness, and health. But the health of our community and the health of our world is a big part of this. We need to pay attention to what's going on around us and to do what we can to ensure that ourselves, our neighbors, our families are living in a world that is safe and allows for us to grow, be prosperous, be healthy. And sometimes we have to expand that view beyond the very personal in terms of our health and spirituality to what's going on around us, to the ethics and morals of our community. It's all part of being a holistic person. So I want to, I'm very grateful to Michael McCray for bringing this perspective to the program. With regard to our regular work, we're going to be continuing with that, delving into the inner spirit, soul consciousness, learning how to uplift that and awaken that to its fullest potential. So I invite you to stay tuned in to PRN, as well as tune in for Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium. on Saturdays at 6 p.m. For those of you who would like to connect with me personally, I'm Catherine Davis. My email is heartofmindradio@gmail.com. heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And my websites are katherine.one and qigongonline.net. That's QIGONGONLINE.net. And on those websites, you'll find out about my teaching schedule and my work in energy healing so that you can really connect directly. If you want to find more about blogs and other such things, you could also go to the archive page on PRN.FM and just search Heart of Mind Radio, and you'll see that there. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. This has been Heart of Mind Radio, and we look forward to joining you again next week. Bye for now.